testing. This is a recording of an interview with Colonel Miller. Colonel Miller, why were you, how did you end up in the death watch as it was? Could you give us a sequence of events of your service activity before?
In the winter of 1941, I was ordered to duty at Fort Sill, Oklahoma, and went there, was on duty with school troops until the middle of April, when I got orders to go to the Philippines. So in the middle of April, I went to the West Coast and went on a troop ship to the Philippines, getting orders to go to Fort Stockton-Burg, the artillery cavalry post, about 60 miles north of Manila. After my arrival at Fort Stockton-Burg, I was in command of an artillery battery of Philippine scouts and participated in maneuvers, some of them definitely designed to meet any enemy on the beaches in the Philippines. This training continued on in through the summer and into the fall of 1941. The declaration of war, December the 8th, because we were on the other side of the international dateline, put us into the field, and we were in combat, so to speak, from the very first day of World War II. We left our post to go into the field, and gradually, as the Japanese landed and pushed us on back into Bataan, where we went into our first real combat. Combat started for us on the 2nd of January 1942, and from then until the surrender of Bataan on April the 8th, I was on duty with the 24th Field Artillery, moving from a battery command up to the Battalion S3, Plans and Training Officer. The day of the surrender found my artillery battalion back on the lower end of Bataan. We were surrendered by the official order of our commander, General King, and the Japanese moved in, disarmed us, and then lined us up and started marching us out of Bataan. We called it the March Out of Bataan. After we came back, we found that the American newspaper people had characterized this as the Death March. So I made the Death March and went into prison camp then, about 15 miles north of where I had formerly been on duty, Fort Stockton-Burg. This prison camp was at Camp O'Donnell, or O'Donnell.
At this time, what was your rank in service?
I was a captain, and I remained a captain all during my my service and during my period of captivity. We had no promotions because we were all frozen in grade while we were prisoners.
Yes, sir. After the war, and could you give us events pretty briefly of your college activity, where you went to college and where you taught since, and how you ended up here at A&I?
Well, briefly, my service. After I was released from the hospital, all of us underwent intensive hospitalization and checking. I was on ROTC duty in San Francisco Bay Area for 3 years, and then went on intelligence duty, going to the intelligence school at Fort Holabird, Maryland, then with 3 years in Austria and Italy, and retired on physical disability when the medics finally caught up with me. In the fall of 1952. I was retired in January 1953. Having no other plans for retirement, and it's coming rather suddenly, we moved up to Fayetteville, Arkansas, and out of sheer boredom, I started taking college courses and eventually ended up with my master's degree in history at the University of Arkansas.
At this time, could you give a sort of a general reaction of men when they were captured into the march, and if you have any statistics as to how many of them made started the march and how many of them finished it.
Yes, some of the people, well, apparently felt that the whole world had fallen in on top of them. They apparently had never run into any really bad luck or hard times, and they didn't fare so well. This was particularly true among the very young people who couldn't take it emotionally. The result was that they got into trouble with their captors. And of course, as long as we were in contact with combat troops, they didn't have very long life expectancy. The older people didn't fare so well because of their physical ability to stand up. So really, you might say those people from between 25 and 45 had the best chance of survival because of physical condition and, I think, mental ability to sort of absorb the bad and just look forward to the to a future that just had to hold out something better than what we had at that particular time. The extreme pessimists died off fairly early. The extreme optimists, oddly enough, didn't do so well either. The people who thought that the war was going to end the next day, because they would set themselves deadlines and for freedom, and when these deadlines went by, then they lose hope. The I'd say the average person, the average American, did well if he was well, if he had friends that would help him over his mental and physical low spots. The loner didn't survive. Either the man who was way out front or who drug his heels too far.
Do you have any statistics as to how many started it and how many ended up making it?
This has been guessed at. I'd say guessed at because you must recall that we lost all of our records when the Japanese moved in and took us over. They were not interested at all in preserving American personnel records. And we weren't about to carry these things along with us because of the burden and the fact that we couldn't see any sense in it. And the War Department has never released any figures officially. The figures that I give some value to is that approximately 17,000 Americans and Filipinos died on the so-called Death March.
And they started out?
Well, this again is difficult. There was a total of 21,000 Americans in the Philippines. Some of them were on Corregidor, and so you have to subtract the Corregidor people from the total to get a figure that you could take place on Bataan, because the Bataan Death March did not include the Corregidor people. And then, of course, you have the Filipinos in there, and the Filipinos were evacuated and marched out, not right with the Americans, but they're more or less sandwiched in between the American columns. So there is no accurate figure on it, but the figure 17,000, I think, is approximately right.
Well, now I'd like to ask you about what happens to the inner man under these circumstances in different categories, and start out with socially. How does your changes in attitude or toward life and your fitting towards your fellow man, things like that?
I thought your question was going to be slanted over to did the social conditions enjoyed by or the individual prisoner prior to imprisonment have any, have any value in computing his chance for survival. We talked a great deal about this in prison camp. They did the old country boy with no education have a better chance to survive than, say, the educated city boy? Did the professional soldier, the West Pointer, so to speak, or and the career EM, have a better chance? This is what we talked about a great deal. I'd say offhand that the previous economic background of the prisoner didn't have very much to do with his surviving. The West Pointer failed to meet prison life and to come through it in about the same rate as, say, the non-West Pointer. The enlisted man, the same as the officer. I've always maintained that it is a part of family background and family stability that gives a man the best chance during any period of, say, extreme hardship. If a man is used to giving and taking and is accustomed to a certain amount of hard luck, then his world hasn't ended when he does run into a string of bad luck. But our attitude towards our fellow man, I don't think I've changed any. I don't think I'm any more critical. I occasionally look around and mentally judge someone as someone I wouldn't want to be in a tight place with. But I don't think we arrived at any great depth of perception that we could say judge our fellow man better than, say, if we had not been in a prison camp and under these conditions.
Well, how did you feel about the Japanese in reference to before the war and during captivity and now the present time?
Well, I had a typical American attitude. I'll always maintain that we were more or less victims of our own propaganda. The Japs, as we called them, they couldn't see at night, and they were mechanical people. They were copyists and had no originality. And all you had to do was use the old Lexington and Concord formula and hand an American a gun, and you made a soldier out of him. I concluded at the end of the my prison life that I was just beginning to learn the Japanese. They're a very complex people, and they are they're patriotic in their way. I respect them. I don't admire them. There's certainly a difference in that feeling. I don't say that they were forced into defending themselves, but they were convinced by their own leaders that they were forced, that this was about all they could back up. And if they didn't fight, well, then they would be subordinate to the white men in the Far East. But the Japanese, I think, have very admirable qualities. There's no laziness among them. They're dedicated to their race and to their country, and as I think people should be. But I think the war was completely unnecessary and was carried on because of an arrogance among the military headed by Tojo and not stopped by a very weak emperor, and that the war wasn't necessary, but the Japanese war leadership felt it was, and of course the people went right along with it because they were completely controlled. Japan was able to wage all-out war because they did control the people from well, from the cradle all the way to the grave. They maintained beyond the grave.
How did you feel about the United States as after you got in this war? Were you still as much behind them and thought they were right?
Oh, yes. And of course, we never had any efforts directed towards us as were directed towards the the prisoners in the Korean police action, as Harry Truman called it, because we were fighting a nation in the case of fighting Japan, whereas in the case of the Korean affair, this is long ideological lines, and the Japanese made no effort to, say, convert us, because we could never be Japanese. You were either born a Japanese or you were a non-Japanese. So they ignored us and made no attempt to propagandize us. Oh, they bragged about their successes and resented their failures, and usually would vent their ill temper on us when they, when their failures became known to them, handed down very carefully and slowly from their high command. But we had no pressure on us. So there's no comparison between the treatment that we got as captives and the prisoners of the Korean and Chinese communists, because they were subjects of brainwashing and propagandizing, trying to turn them into communists, whereas we didn't have that danger.
How are you feeling towards your family at home? Did you lose interest in them, or did you forget about them, or did they one of the things that kept you going, or just how did you feel about your family?
I think this is always true, even in the all the prisoners who say didn't have a wife and children. It was directed towards mother and or father, or say a home area where there were relatives. Some of them maybe not too close. I think we all identify ourselves as a part of a family unit and superimpose that identity into a geographic identity, and we didn't sit around and think about them all the time. Naturally, you would drive yourself into a into depression if you did so. You had no way of verifying that that they knew that you were alive. I found out after I got back that I had actually been listed as missing in action for over 9 months, and that my wife didn't know whether I was dead or alive until December of 1942, when she finally got it through the International Red Cross. The little bit of mail that we got transmitted through the Swiss International Red Cross was pretty limited in its news value, and about all we were allowed to send on our postal cards after we'd been prisoners a year was a simple statement that we were alive and that we were, say, doing well. We had to check on a postal card, a foreign card, to send back home. I think the International Red Cross miserably failed on this, because they had a Swiss representative in Japan who had married a Japanese woman, and he was more Japanese than Swiss.
See. Could you tell us what happened to the physical body at this time, as far as your steps in starvation, and what did you have to eat or anything at all? How long did you have to go without food?
Well, we have to go back into the beginning of our combat in Bataan. We moved into the Bataan Peninsula in the last day of night of the last day of 1941, and on January the 1st, 1942, we were in combat positions. Within the first week, we got an order out that all rations would be reduced by 50%, so we were on half rations, and these were Filipino rations, not American rations, and this was reduced to one-third ration 2 months later in March. The first thing we ran out of was quinine, and of course this was before the days of Ativan, so most, I'd say almost all, according to the doctors that I talked to in prison camp and afterwards, 95% of us had malaria. Unfortunately, I didn't have, and all of us suffered from malnutrition. general debilitation from the very beginning. The week previous to the actual surrender, in the first week of April, found us moving back too rapidly. We'd run out of rations and even were unable to get this one-third ration that officially we were supposed to get. And so I would say that we were getting about 500 or 600 calories a day during the last 2 weeks in combat. Then the march was made with no food, and we began to get...
How long was the march?
In distance was about 75 miles. In time, it varied according to where you were picked up and how your particular group was treated by the Japanese guards. In my particular group, we had a stupid bird colonel who tried to conceal a 45 automatic pistol in his musette bag. So he was taken out the side of the road at Belonga and shot, and then as punishment to us, we were marched 22 hours on through the rest of the day and on to the night and into the next afternoon without food and without rest, except twice we stopped for a change of guard. And we were fortunate in that we were using our body reserves, and it rained that night, so we did have water. But the people who followed us in subsequent columns didn't fare so well, and they had a much higher death rate because they would, say, march 10 or 15 miles, and then they'd be put off to one side of the road and left there without food and water for a couple of days, and then they'd march another 15 or 20 miles, and then some of them took as high as 13 days to get out. Their death rate was very much higher than ours.
What was the longest period of time you went without food?
Approximately 7 days without any food whatsoever.
Well, under these conditions, what happens to your strength and your physical body? Do you become real weak and lose weight?
Yeah, you lose weight. You are no longer hungry after about 24 hours if you don't eat anything. Your stomach just finally apparently just wells together, and you actually lose interest in food. We had to force ourselves to eat and eat slowly when we were finally given a chance to eat some rice after this long period without food.
Did you think about food all the time?
After we got into prison camp, we had to force ourselves not to think about food. If you didn't watch, you'd immediately shear off into from whatever subject was being talked about in your little group that you were in and begin to reminisce about food, or somebody would make a remark, well, boy, how'd you like to have a good ham sandwich? And this would start off on a tangent on ham and the different ways of cooking ham and so forth. And of course, we found that this was a self-destroying thing, in that you get a food fixation. So we began to shy away from being with people who talked about food, even while we were sitting down to our little dab of rice at our meals. In fact, I remember I was in one group where we set up a little device introducing subjects other than food to talk about while we were eating, so we would ignore the food that we were getting. And most of us shied away from food hounds because they didn't last too long.
Well, what happens to your taste during this period?
Your taste gets very much sharper. Let's say if you were lucky enough to get a hold of a little bit of salt. The salt was the saltiest salt you ever tasted in your life. And late in prison camp, we got some Red Cross boxes, and included in this was a little bit of powdered coffee. And this coffee was the strongest, the best tasting. Of course, nowadays, if someone offered me a cup of coffee made with powdered coffee, I'd be polite, but I wouldn't drink it. Your body has the ability to get the utmost out of a small amount of food when your body is way down. Of course, your strength leaves you, and you finally get around to the point where you, say, lean over to lace your shoes, and you black out, and we had to watch each other, say, in the morning when we were dressing, and you begin to calculate, well, now, do I want to go over and talk to so-and-so because I'll have to walk about 50 feet? Is it worth it? And this is what you do whenever food gets very, very scarce and your body has pulled down gradually, and with your body weight being absorbed. And it's, we average 45 pounds per man loss of weight. I lost 60 pounds during my prison camp.
What happens to your physical senses of sight and hearing?
So a lot of people had trouble with their eyes, and fortunately I didn't have. Of course, your lack of vitamin A will affect your eyes, but your reaction time has slowed down very, very much. We had some psychologists with us who gave us these tests of reactions to certain or stated conditions, and one of the typical ones would be to moving down the road, you know, go 4 miles east and then 3 miles west and 2 miles north and south and so forth, and they would work this around, and they would time us on how long it would take us to say arrive at an answer, and they told us that our reactive time was very, very slow. Our heartbeat slowed down until the doctor just couldn't believe it.
What did you do during the day in the camp? Did you have any available material to read, or?
We had a small amount to read, but in my camp, in Sensuji in Japan, we organized classes, and these were taught without textbooks. I taught American Naval History. I took a course in thermodynamics from an American engineer who taught it without the benefit of textbook. I took another one on air conditioning. I took one in British Naval History. I took a course in British Finance. And I took some courses in Far Eastern Geography given by fellow prisoners. We could take I think it was 7 different languages, which did not include Japanese. Our language college was quite large in enrollment.
What did you give me some happenings and details of what the Japanese did to you, and what you did in return to them, and as far as punishment or brutality, or were any of them nice to you, or all of them the same?
Well, I think the most difficult thing for us to really work out was the unpredictability of the Japanese. The Japanese would be very friendly, say, and then suddenly, without any apparent reason, apparently, well, at least it wasn't apparent to us, would turn and be quite vicious. So we soon learned not to get friendly, or to make any friendly overtures in the hope of, say, getting better treatment or better food. Some people weren't smart enough to see this, with the result that they usually got into pretty serious trouble. But we endured it, and if there was any general hazing of all the prisoners, without it being directed towards an individual who might have offended as an individual, we soon found that it was because they had received bad news on the war front, and that they were just taking their feelings out on us. So we would, say, get cheered up by a certain amount of hazing, not liking it. But still, there was this feeling that, well, they're mean today because they're really giving them hell, saying the Marianas or the Sudan and New Guinea. And, of course, this hazing increased as the American forces approached closer and closer to the main islands of Japan.
Testing, testing. Was there any time they'd take prisoners out and just say, go out, take some of them out and shoot them or something like this?
Well, we had our first case of that that we thought was completely, well, senseless and unplanned, more or less vengeance, was at the end of the death march. When we got to this prison compound at Camp O'Donnell, we were taken out into a big field before we were actually allowed into the prison compound, and we stripped off and piled everything we had onto the ground in front of us, and they went through everything very carefully. They took away knives and razor blades and matches, and we noticed that they took a few of the prisoners out of the group. They tell them to move over, and to in fact, in my group there were about six out of this 700 or 800, and they disappeared. And from the compound we watched other groups coming in, and we saw the same procedure. We found out later that those people were taken out and being and shot, but the reason they were shot was that they had accumulated Japanese souvenirs during combat. As they find a Japanese dead soldier, and in accordance with military orders, you were supposed to take off all documents and anything that the man had which might be of military value. Of course, those of us in combat who came in contact with these dead soldiers did bundle it up and send it back, stating the condition where we found this material. And sometimes there was some money, and sometimes a little Japanese flag, and diaries, and so forth. Well, these people in headquarters were pulling some of those things out and keeping them as souvenirs instead of sending them on back to higher headquarters for intelligence evaluation. Well, that was what was happening in this shakedown. They concluded that these people who had Japanese money, Japanese flags, and pictures and so forth, the things of non-military value, had been, as they said, robbing the dead. And so they shot them as ghouls rather than for their having committed any direct act against the Japanese.
What was the death rate at the camp? You know,
it was very high at first. Remember, we were in this malarial country. We had no quinine after the first week or so of January, and we were still in a malarial country in prison camp. And so malaria, chills, and fever, and with this very low calorie input, the people would begin to die from, say, malaria. And our rate was about 10% at the very beginning, and it gradually scaled down as the number of people who were very, very weak and the sickest, until by the time we left the Philippines 7 months later, our death rate had dropped down to maybe 50 a day out of 10,000 prisoners. But then when we got up into the main islands of Japan, in the wintertime of 1942-43, then pneumonia began to hit us, and here it was again, a chill, a cold, which would be thrown off normally, would go into pneumonia, and we would then have to carry our dead out every day. I was in a camp in Japan in November of 1942, and out of 500 prisoners, we were carrying out 10 a day. But by, say, March, this had scaled down until we only had, say, one death a week. By the summer of 1943, all of the weaklings had died. And so from then on, it was rather rare to have a death, despite the fact that we were getting about 1,200 calories a day.
Under all this strain and experience you went through, what kind of effect has it had on you since then?
I don't know, and I don't know that I can't analyze myself. It certainly hasn't haunted me, and I don't have nightmares, don't dream about it, and when a couple or more of us get together and talk about prison camp days, it's always the amusing things or the funny things, and we avoid even today being with people who say do dramatize their prison camp experiences. I don't mind talking about it, but it's certainly not a unique thing in world history, nor even in modern history. But it should be talked about because it's a reality. It happened. But we kind of laugh about it among ourselves. But our group is getting pretty thin, and there's a pretty small number of us left.
The effect on the memory, does everybody remember exactly what happened, or do they?
Now, those of us who had sleep or malaria have had trouble with their memory, but I don't think that my memory is, I'll say, any different than what it would have been under other, I'll say, more normal life during the period like this. I don't have any trouble with my history, I don't think. I think you're more selective in what's important enough to bother about. Mm-hmm. Well, you certainly can get excited. You're like food. I couldn't care less what's on the table. Food is there, and so instead of worrying about it, it's something to accept and eat and enjoy. And if it's not there, well, you're not going to die in 10 minutes. I think you adopt a philosophy of life of not letting little things develop into major things. But I can't see that it's in any way abnormal, meaning that it's vastly different from the average person.
During the march and captivity, what did the prisoners do to forget about the strife that they were in?
Well, of course, in the march, friends stayed together and tried to help each other. I was in a group with a old good friend of mine, a Red Army captain that had been with me in combat in my battalion. There was a Texas medical officer, Latinx fashion, and the two of us thought that we had to help old Poncho, as we called him, along. So we'd kid him along and move along with him and say, don't let these so-and-sos get you down, Poncho, and so forth. You watched your friends and walked along in little groups. And this, of course, kept you busy. And, of course, you were always looking for a chance to get a little water out of the mud hole in the middle of the road or something like that. In prison camp, we talked about most everything, family, friends, experiences, anything, as I say, except food. And then, of course, we had these later on, after we stabilized in a prison camp in Japan, Then we set up these organized classes and took the equivalent of history lecture, of college lecture courses.
Did any of these men go berserk?
Very early. We had a number of people go crazy. Of course, we had a number of them go crazy on the death march. And they were usually killed because they try to break out away from their friends. Their friends would try to restrain them. So if they broke ranks and got off to one side, the guards would either bayonet them, shoot them, and just leave them in the road there for an object lesson. But when we got into prison camp and were more or less our own internal guard, when we found a person, say, acting strangely and apparently becoming, irrational, we put them into a building and guard them and take their food to them, and usually they didn't last more than a week. They just quit living in about a week's time.
Well, that's another question I was going to ask, is how many of them would just want to give up and die?
This was fairly common early. Typical case is a young officer, a friend of mine, maybe 10 years my junior at that time. And he said one day, one afternoon, we were sitting around talking, and he's talking about his college life in Utah and something or another, and he finally just turned around to me and he said, you know, I don't think they're ever going to come get us. Now, this was in October of 1942. I said, oh, don't be silly. And everybody else tried to cheer him up. He said, no, it's just not worth it. He said, I know I'm not going to make it. Well, the next morning, he just didn't wake up. He quit living. He lost the desire to live. And you could say he committed suicide. Now, we had a number of these people who just quit living. You could see it in their faces when they just suddenly decide that, I'm just not going to make it.
What freedoms did you have while you were in captivity? Free to go about as you had wanted to?
Move around within our camp area in during certain hours, during the daylight hours. And but we didn't have any freedom to, say, congregate together. These classes I talk about, these had to be faked because the Japanese forbid us to be in groups of more than three, because they figured that we were plotting an escape if we got together. So maybe we'd be sitting out against the fence if it was a nice sunny day in the winter, or in a shady spot if it was in the summer. And apparently we'd be just lying around, sleeping or mending clothes. And the instructor would be sitting there with, making as though he's sewing on a shirt. And he would give his lecture. At nights, after we were allowed to lie down, after 8 o'clock we were allowed to lie down, and lights were out at 9, sometimes 10, the instructor would be sitting at a table in the middle of the room, and everybody else would be apparently asleep, except one man who would be at the door. And this man in the at the table would be the lecturer. And so he'd give us a lecture while we were lying there, and with the man at the door watching to see that the internal guard didn't come in and punish the whole group. The Japanese did not believe in allowing the prisoners to in any way rule themselves internally, nor to ever forget that they were prisoners of war.
Were any of these classes ever discovered?
Oh. Once in a while, somebody would make a bone, and so there would be a big uproar in the group, say, in a room, would be taken out, and then they slapped around, and particularly the man who was supposed to have been the ringleader, and especially if he'd gotten in trouble prior to that, maybe not standing at attention properly or something. For a couple of days, well, we would have to break off all classes and give them an occasion to pick out another group. But in about 3 or 4 days, the whole thing would be over, and so then we'd go back to our normal routine.
or any attempts to escape, maybe?
We had a case of four escaping in the Philippines. Now, the Japanese had a neat system on that. They divided us up into groups of 10 and registered the groups in their headquarters. And so if one man out of the 10 escaped, they would execute the other 9. And so these four people escaped, and they were getting ready to execute the 36 people in the four groups that they represented. But the escapees were captured. Of course, they couldn't go any place. They were on the main island, Luzon, in the Philippines. So they brought them in, and then we were forced to watch their beheading. And so this group was not punished. However, there's another case. Out on the work party, a group of enlisted men were out on a brick building job in the Philippines, and three of them escaped, and the Japanese executed 27 people as group punishment. And of course, this is a doggone good way to keep people together, because if you're in one of this blood brother group, as we call it, you're going to watch the other 9 men in your group, and they're going to be watching you. And so if one man goes to the bathhouse and latrine, you'll find 9 of them going with him. And if one man decides he wants to go down and see a friend in another part of the camp, you'll see the other 9 going with him. So it was a vicious thing. But that's the way they did things.
Is there any trouble among the 10 if one of them would say something about trying to escape? What would the other 9 do to
it? The other 9 would absolutely put a day and night watch on them, because usually out of a group of 10, there would be a majority who would be reasonable enough to know that this was an impossible thing. If they escaped, say, in the Philippines, they were still 8,000 miles from the United States. And the Filipino would be punished if he hid them away or tried to help them. And of course, it was even more stupid when we got up to Japan, because there you were in an enemy country and no means of transportation, with the coast all being guarded and the roads all being patrolled for possible paratrooper landings and everything else. So we usually regarded anybody who even contemplated escape as a mental case that had to be watched. And so everybody would watch anyone who even indicated that they might be thinking about escaping.
Are there any in your group that said anything about it?
No. It's my one little story of volunteering. I was asked one day by my colonel if I would take command of a prisoner of war work group of enlisted men. And I told him I didn't think that I wanted to. And then it occurred to me that I would have the privilege of selecting the officers who would command each of the four platoons. So I took that. And so I went around and picked 9 officers that I knew. First one I picked was a Catholic chaplain. He was my executive officer. So the two of us went around, and knowing these people, we picked 8 more people that we could absolutely trust. And then we went down the rolls of these enlisted men and put the steady people together, knowing that usually they'd call in a sergeant and say, "Well, now, why don't you go out and pick yourself 9 people out of this whole group?" So he'd pick out his 9 and pick out another one. And we finally ended up with 2 groups of 8 balls that didn't trust each other. And so if one of them escaped, just cold-bloodedly, we figured that it would be probably a bit of a riddance, because these 8 balls are going to get us all in trouble anyway. You got to looking at things in a pretty cold-blooded way when it comes up to your life or somebody else's foolishness.
Were any of the Japanese guards friendly to you?
No, as I said earlier, that we were never able to project a friendship into anything more than just an immediate situation. As a matter of fact, the people who gave us the most trouble were American citizens of Japanese ancestry who saw the war coming and went back to Japan. And so they were used as camp guards because they understood the English language. And they're the ones that gave us the most trouble because I think they felt the most guilty about being in the position they were in. And you may have noted in the in the newspapers a few years after the war was over that one of these guards was caught in Los Angeles. He sneaked back in over here, and one of the ex-POWs saw him, had him arrested, and they tried him, and he was condemned to death for, say, causing prisoner of war deaths. But he was given a life sentence, believe it was during Harry Truman's time, and then during Eisenhower's administration, was given a pardon with the stipulation that he leave the country.
Are there any, have any examples of extreme cruelty?
Well, of course, this is a relative thing. We had cases of prisoners who would offend in some mild way, and they would be put into a prison in the compound there, a barred room, and zero weather, and they throw ice water in through on him, and people lose toes and sometimes even their feet. And of course, the unmerciful beatings that they would give people for, which sometimes turn out to be a very trivial affair. And a good deal of the treatment, though, was complete indifference to our conditions. And now we had a Japanese doctor in this one camp in Japan who refused to give American Red Cross medical supplies that were in his office, in the prison there. So when we got back, made out depositions against some of these people, camp commanders and interpreters and guards. And so the War Crimes Commission tried those people after the war was over, and I believe that they executed 17 as a total. They gave prison sentences to many more than that.
From the time that you were captured, how long was before you were released?
Well, I was a prisoner of war 42 months, 1,250 days, from the surrender on Matan until liberation in Japan.
Were you liberated immediately after the war was over?
No. We had been moved to Japan. My group, about 1,500, had been moved up to Japan in November of 42, and I went into a camp near Osaka for about 8 or 9 months, and I moved over to another one on the island Shikoku. And then in June of 1945, they moved all the Americans. The number, I think, was probably about 350, moved us up into the Japanese Alps, about 100 miles west of Tokyo on the Korean side of the main island of Honshu. And for some reason or another, this camp was not registered with the Red Cross. So we got the word, I think the 18th of August, the war was over. And so we just sat there. And days and days went on and on, and nobody came around. The Japanese had turned their guns over to us. And we were watching the young people, prisoners, scared that they would start something. And finally, one of our officers went out and called Tokyo, got hold of MacArthur's headquarters, expressed surprise that we were up there. They didn't know anything about us, so then they had a food drop, and a B-29 came over and dropped us food and medicine and uniform. They sent up a so-called liberation team. All it was 4 doctors and 4 nurses and 4 photographers. And then they took us out, arranged for transportation, and took us out. We got out on the 2nd of September. That's when they were signing the armistice on Missouri in Tokyo Bay.
What happened immediately after you were liberated?
Well, we went into Yokohama, and there we had a big reception. Military commanders, and they had 24-hour chow lines, and there were two Navy Red Cross hospital ships there. And those of us who could not, say, move around our own power, litter cases were taken directly aboard and were taken to the States by these hospital ships. The rest of us, for some reason, known only to bureaucracy, were taken in transports down to the Philippines, and there were reshipped then back to the States. I got dengue fever and was considered a hospital patient a little bit longer, so I got a hospital plane back to the States, landing in San Francisco in October of 1945. We were given practically unlimited leave, given first a delay en route to the hospital, whichever one we wanted to go to. And so after 90 days delay en route, not chargeable to leave, I reported in the Army-Navy hospital. The doctor glanced at me, he had other things to do, combat casualties and really sick people. I was gaining weight at the rate of 10 pounds a week, and was having a good time. So when he suggested that I take some convalescent leave, I said, well, that'd be all right if I could I want to go to Mexico. He said, well, fine. So they gave me 3 months leave, hospital leave. So I went to Mexico City, took my two pre-teenage daughters out of school. My wife and I went to Mexico City, and so that's where I did my convalescent leave. Actually, the Army didn't know what to do with us. And until the people began to get out of the service and the Army settled down in some sort of permanent policy towards the size of the Army, they just assumed for us not to bother them. So eventually, I went on ROTC duty in San Francisco, and from there, then I went over to Europe and had a three-year tour with my family over there.
What do you mean by hazing? What did they do?
Well, make you fall out, say, at 4 o'clock in the morning with temperature at, say, 10 above, and just stand there at attention for, say, 4 or 5 hours. And if you wavered, well, they'd hit you with whatever they had, a bamboo or a 2x4 or whatever they happened to have in their hand at that time. Or, say, making you dog trot around the compound until you just fell from exhaustion. And then when you fell, well, then they'd stand there and kick you, and then you'd get up. The hazing was physical, strictly. The fact that we were in prison camp, of course, was a mental a feeling of complete frustration. You couldn't get back at them.